The War on Milfoil. When the weather gets warm, many of us head to the water and bring our boats and personal watercraft along for the ride. But this is also one way that aquatic invasives, such as milfoil, find their way into lakes and ponds, threatening to choke out other plants and animals. This advance is being met with resistance by dedicated and persistent eradication teams that monitor these plants and pull, cut, or in some cases apply herbicides in the effort to control their spread. I'm Keith Shortall, and today on the program we'll talk with a panel of experts on the front lines of this war about how these plants affect local aquatic ecosystems. We'll learn more about how to identify invasives, about some of the most effective techniques for removing them, or at least keeping them in check, and we'll also learn more about what you can do to prevent the accidental spread of these plants from one lake to another. First, this news. From the MPBN studios, I'm Keith Shortall, and this is Maine Calling. About 5 years ago, a number of groups worried about the future of Maine's lakes and ponds came together and formed the Maine Milfoil Initiative. Now that group has released a guide for the rest of us called the Maine Citizen's Guide to Invasive Aquatic Plant Management. If you're worried about the dreaded milfoil, hydrilla, or other invasive species and don't know what to do, we are here to help. On today's program, three people who have been on the front lines of the battle against these aggressive invasives. Joining us are John McFedrin, a biologist and coordinator of Maine DEP's Invasive Aquatic Species Program, Jacqueline Bailey, aquatic plant biologist and project director at the Maine Milfoil Initiative at St. Joseph's College, and Pam Wilkinson, president of the Little Sebago Lake Association. Welcome, all of you, to Maine Calling.
Thank you.
John McFedrin, we'll start with you for no other reason than you're a biologist, and also I roomed with your brother Tom at Boys State at UMaine Orono in the mid-70s.
Sounds like a good reason.
So for those of us who don't spend a lot of time near a lake or don't have property or may not just know anything about these invasives, what are aquatic invasives and the plants that I just mentioned, hydrilla and milfoil?
We're talking just today about invasive aquatic plants. I just want to mention that, make that clear, because there are a lot of other organisms that can be invasive and can cause harm to the environment when introduced, fish, mussels, and other organisms. But today our focus is on invasive aquatic plants. And these are plants that are not in their native environment and enter a new environment and can cause harm in that new environment. They alter the habitat. They might that is our native habitat for fish and other insects and other critical parts of the food system. So it's a plant that is in a new place and can cause harm in that environment.
So let's take milfoil, for example. Where did it come from and how did it get here?
Well, not to confuse the matter, but there are actually native milfoils in the state that are native to Maine, native to this part of the country. So what we're talking about are milfoil species that are not native to this part of the United States, and most of them come from Eurasia. Another number of plants were introduced in the Victorian era for water gardening, and eventually maybe were escaped or were, you know, somebody may have had them in an aquarium and dumped them because nobody likes to kill plants or kill animals on the whole. And then once they're in a public water body or a recreational water body, then there's a potential for them to move to other water bodies, mostly by human use, on boats, on trailers, and in fishing gear and on anchor lines.
So there are these indigenous species of milfoil which do not cause trouble? Are they all invasive to some degree? Or
They tend not to. The ones that are not from here do not have the same controls in their population that some of our native plants do. I will grant that native plants can grow densely, and we do get calls from people about so-called nuisance growths that turn out to be native plants. But on the whole, they do not develop into the monocultures that we see with the invasive aquatic plants that are come from other continents.
So, Jackie Bailey, then, when does a plant just become a nuisance plant and turn the corner into invasive? What's the definition, I guess, of invasive?
Well, an invasive plant is one that, as John mentioned, really becomes a monoculture. You no longer have that mixing and variety of plants that you typically do in a native plant bed. You just see that one species typically.
And that's a bad thing because
it really changes the structure of the area, so it can become very dense and very thick. So the types of fish that use that type of a plant would be very different than those that would use a native plant bed.
And so if you had a Eurasian milfoil infestation or whatever you call it, and you discovered a patch, what would happen if you just sort of let it go?
Well, there's a potential that it could take over the entire part of a water body where plants can grow. So we could just push out all the natives and completely take over the shorelines.
And it can survive after it's already pushed everything else out? In other words, does it not need other forms of life to keep it alive?
Well, it gets its nutrients from the substrate and the water and that sort of thing. But typically, the way it pushes out some of the natives is that they're often quick growing, so they come up before many of the natives do. They have lots of different reproductive methods, vegetative methods in addition to seeds. So they just sort of have that little bit of a cutting edge over the natives, and so they're able to just push things out and survive well.
All right, we'll continue more learning about these plants. 1-800-399-3566 is the number to call to join the conversation. That's 1-800-399-3566. Talk at mpbn.net. Tweet at Maine Calling, or of course you can just post to our Facebook page because you follow it regularly. To either one of you still then, how do we recognize these plants if you're because I know that you are calling upon citizens and some of us who may not be able to identify these, John. How do we know when we're seeing milfoil or Eurasian milfoil rather, or just some other green plant?
If you go to our website, we have some information on what to do if you find a so-called suspicious plant that you're wondering about or concerned about. You can send us a photograph via email or send a plant sample in. If you want to know more, we have some workshops that are done by the Volunteer Lake Monitoring Program. They're based in Auburn. These workshops are called Invasive Plant Patrol Workshops. You're not trained in those workshops to identify the plants to species because sometimes we have to go to DNA analysis to find out exactly what species it is. But you are trained to recognize the native plants and then be able to discern, okay, well, maybe this one isn't native and we have to check it out. And at that point, if you think it's suspicious, then you can send it to the Volunteer Lake Monitoring Program or to the DEP for identification.
So it's really that hard to identify. So it might look like Eurasian milfoil, but it's not invasive.
It can be. One of the biggest problems with the milfoils is you don't necessarily have the flower stalk. The flower stalk on milfoils sticks up above the surface of the water. If you have that, you will most likely be able to tell what it is. If you just have the submersed portion of the plant, you may not be able to tell.
Pam, you're not a biologist, but you know something about this because
15 years of experience.
Yeah, right. You've seen it and you know it. Tell us about that experience. How did you become interested in this subject? How did it all start?
Well, I was on the board of directors for the Little Spago Lake Association, and we had this person come forward and say that they've had this plant that's growing in their cove and it's taken over. And I've always been an environmentalist and I want to make a difference. And we didn't pay too much attention to it for a couple of years, and then we've really found that it did just what Jackie said. It took over. So we wanted to make a difference, and we worked with DEP for identification and then started our programs.
Did you know then the amount of work that it would take?
Not at all. But what it has done is created a community with our lake. And between education and getting people involved, we have been able to manage our situation so that we are not working as hard in the upper basin. We used to work 5 days a week and for 3 months, and now we're working 5 to 7 days a month.
So what were you doing those 5 days a week? Monitoring, finding, pulling?
There's everything that you would do in a business. You know, there's scheduling, there's getting people ready. We have divers. We hire the divers. They hand pull the roots from the bottom of the lake, feed it into a suction hose. It goes up into a trough and filters the water out. We have two captain and crew on top of the suction dredge, and they, after we survey the area to find out what density the beds are, we send the troops over to hand-pull the milfoil.
So it had not gone so far on Little Sebago that you had such large swaths of invasive milfoil that you couldn't pull it by hand, obviously. That's how you went at it?
It had, yes. We have 23 areas in the upper basin and probably 29 areas, beds that we call, in the lower section, and they were huge. The plants could be anywhere from 10 feet tall, looked like a rhododendron bush under the water. And you physically had to hand pull that out from the bottom and feed it into the hose to take it out of the lake. You could not hand pull it because it was too dense.
So, and I'm wondering, like much like the Japanese knotweed in my yard, I tried to take the whole root, but is there a way to pull it to not leave residual bits that can regrow? Or
they're trained. The divers are trained through VLMP and the state, and they do feed their hands under the root, try to reach all the root, and take it out, and hopefully they accomplish getting the whole plant.
And the hand pulling was deemed the best solution for Little Sebago in this case, but there are other methods.
There are. The benthic barriers, we worked with those. In the cove area that was first identified, we put, I think it was 40 benthic barriers down and flipped those every, 60 to 90 days. But that's labor intensive if you're taking a benthic barrier that's 20 by 20 or 20 by 30 and flipping it in the water. It takes a lot of muscle power strength, especially if it's 5 feet to 10 feet down.
Sure. So, John McFedrin of benthic barriers is much like the same principle as the cloth that you put over plants on landscaping material. Mm-hmm. It's basically blocks out sunlight.
Blocks out sunlight. Also, physically smothers the plants. That's one method of manual control. Another method is what Pam talked about, which is to remove the plant by hand. We have different ways of collecting it. Some accelerate this diverse-assisted suction process in an accelerated way. So we can pull plants. I don't do a lot of pulling myself and recognize that so much of this work is done by groups like Little Sebago Lake Association and many other groups out there that are working hard. So we can pull. You can cover the plants with the benthic barrier, which is essentially a blanket on the bottom. Those are moved after a couple of months to new areas. And then another tool that is in our toolbox is the use of herbicides. Chemicals are used in certain instances. In most cases where we've used them thus far are in new populations of plants that are particular species that are particularly aggressive, and they're known to be only in a couple of 2 to 3 lakes in the entire state.
So herbicides are a limited approach for certain plants in certain locations.
Right. It's something that is always in the mix in terms of our thinking, and it's in the quiver, if you will, but it's one that is determined on a case-specific basis depending on the pond, the objective of control, because you need to think about what are you trying to do here. Eradication of these plants is very difficult to achieve.
Jackie, the Maine Milfoil Initiative, what is it and how has it begun?
Well, the Maine Milfoil Initiative was started actually with a group of folks from Little Sebago Lake who really wanted to do something more and find a way to bring some additional funding into the lake groups that were fighting the milfoil effort. So they approached St. Joseph's College about running the program. And working with St. Joseph's, they reached out to Senator Collins and Snow and secured $500,000 from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to get the program going.
And so what does it do now?
Well, the culmination of the project is actually the Maine Citizens Guide, which just came out. The project brought together 7 lake groups as test lakes and helped them really bring their management efforts to the next level. So for some lakes, it was a matter of purchasing equipment and just very beginning stages. And for others, it was sort of allowing them to have more time on the water and more people out there working.
So it's kind of a template for people tackling this problem without having to reinvent the wheel in terms of how the organization works or all the scheduling that Pam was talking about.
Right. I think what happens is, you know, we had 5 years of experience, and you take that and you build upon it. We were blessed to have an engineer who developed the suction dredge, And we passed on that information, and other people used it in various different ways. They morphed it into baskets instead of a trough. So instead of them recreating the wheel again, we were able to pass on this information and put it in a guide so that they don't have to go through the steps that we went through initially.
And where do people find the guide?
Well, for those lakes that are infested, they can actually request from DEP a hard copy of the guide. But for everyone else, it's right online. It's www.mainevlmp.org/citizensguide.
Okay, and we'll repeat that. We'll also have it on our Facebook page and on our website for anyone who is listening. Again, the number 800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. We've been talking a lot about how to get rid of these plants, but we're going to go next to how to prevent it from becoming infested in the first place. And we'll take a call from Karen in Windham, who has a comment or question about that. But first, we're going to take a short break. This is Maine Calling. Stay with us.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Casella, committed to safe, efficient disposal of non-recyclable waste for all 16 Maine counties. Casella, giving resources new life. Revision Energy, now offering Own Your Power loans for solar energy systems. More at revisionenergy.com. And Maine's public universities. Join the people who are making Maine even smarter and stronger. Learn more at think.maine.edu.
On the next Fresh Air, veterinarian and animal behaviorist Vint Verga, author of The Soul of All Living Creatures. He diagnoses and treats behavior problems in pets as well as animals in zoos. We'll talk about overeating, separation anxiety, hyperactivity, and how he helps anxious animals feel more secure. Join us.
Join us for Fresh Air this evening at 7 o'clock. MPBN is searching for a digital director to help MPBN meet the online, digital, and social media needs and expectations of MPBN radio, television, and online audiences into the future. This position is a senior-level position that will help strategize, develop, and guide MPBN's movement to a digital-first organization, ensuring MPBN's valued programs, journalism, and public service offerings meet their full online and digital potential. If this sounds like you or someone you know, and you have an appreciation and passion for MPBN and the mission of public media in the digital age, please let us know. For information about careers at MPBN, visit mpbn.net and click on About. Thanks.
This is Maine Calling. I'm Keith Shortall. Today on the program, the battle against invasive aquatic plants in Maine. With me in the studio, John McFedrin with the Maine DEP, Jacqueline Bailey, Project Director at Maine Milfoil Initiative, and Pam Wilkinson with the Little Sebago Lake Association. We invite you to join the conversation. The number is 1-800-399-3566. That's 800-399-3566. Email talk@mpbn.net, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. We've been talking about eradication, identification. Obviously, a big part of this is preventing these plants from getting into ponds and lakes or spreading in the first place. We'll take our first call. We'll go to Karen in Windham. Hi, Karen.
Hi there.
Hi, go ahead, please.
Hi. First, thank you for keeping this on the radar screen. And second, hello, Jackie. You did our pond once. You checked the whole thing out. And we had it on one side of the river. It's the dammed up portion of the Kuzumskit River that comes out of Sebago. But what's going on now is for years there's been pieces floating by, and I've been diligently picking them up along the beach. But a piece has taken root at the Association Beach. And so I'm wondering if there's anything preventative to be done short of just scouring the shore every few days.
Hi, Karen. How are you? I remember
I
doing
will.
That survey. You have a lovely little pond.
Thank you. I want to keep it that way. And I feel like I kind of dropped the ball and passed it on to some other folks who haven't quite got it rolling again.
Yeah, it's definitely, you guys had a decent sized infestation, and I think that it is a bit of a battle. The fragments piece is definitely important. I think really the only way to stay on top of it is to do exactly what you said and, you know, scour the shorelines for fragments and pick them up wherever you see them, because, of course, any fragment can form a new plant.
Yes, that if we see one newly embedded, should we put something on top of it, just a piece of black mat with a rock on it? I mean, if we don't have the bento mats?
Well, you know, if it's just a single plant, often they can be removed. And, you know, there are folks out there, like at the VLMP, that can teach people how to properly remove a milfoil plant, because it's really key that you want to make sure you're getting all of the roots and
yes,
that the entire plant
that.
Is being removed in the right way. So I would suggest that you actually contact the VLMP or DEP and see about having somebody teach maybe a group of you from the pond how to properly remove.
Okay, I needed that push, and I thank you, and I won't take any more of your time because I'm sure many people have other questions, but carry on with the good work.
All right, Karen, thank you for calling. This may be a silly question. I'll apologize in advance, but what do you do with the milfoil? Say she pulls this plant out. Do we have to worry about once it's out of the water, sending seeds here or there? Do we burn it, throw it away, or does it not matter?
I get satisfaction burning it.
Apart from catharsis, though, is there a biological?
What I like to do, if it comes on shore, I will take it and let it dry out a little bit and actually do burn it in the little fire pit that we have. But our program right now is that we take the onion bags, and they're about 40 pounds when they're wet, 20 when they're dry, put them on a trailer. And we're lucky enough that St. Joseph's College, we take them there for composting. And they use that in their gardening for their plants and vegetables that they use at the college.
So there is a use
there
for
irrigation.
There is a use,
finally. You know, we were thinking for years, what can we do with this? And finally, we were taking it to the transfer station. They were composting it within their compost of other things. But this seems to work out really well, working in partnership with St. Joseph's College as well.
Generally, if the plant is removed, taken to a high, dry place, away from any place where it could wash into the lake, likely to be okay. If people aren't comfortable with that, then we say throw it away just to be safe.
Because you don't want it ending up getting into, you know, a ditch next to your driveway and living there and then finding its way somewhere else as well.
Right.
Yeah. All right, we're going to mention the boat inspection program, but we'll let Karen from Cooper do that for us. Karen, you do boat inspections?
Yes, I do. I'm the coordinator for the Cadiz Lake Association. Years ago, volunteered to set up a courtesy boat inspection program, and when I moved up here to Cooper, I volunteered to help coordinate it. So I just get volunteers to come out. We go and we inspect boats and trailers and fishing equipment and talk to people about invasive plants and the invasive animals. And so that's, you know, a volunteer situation. And I go to the Milfoil Summit in the end of February and get up to date about what's going on. And then I carry the news back to volunteers. And I just wanted to talk about, you know, just briefly mention that if people out there can support courtesy boat inspections and the lake associations that put these on, put them into effect, that would be tremendous, because it's, you know, better to have prevention rather than have to deal with the cure.
Sure. And can you just set us up here and explain how this works? So you have someone coming to your local waterway, and maybe they're from out of state or from a different part of Maine, and they pull their boat up. And what do you do? Kind of go up to them and say, well, wait a second before you go in. I need to look at the bottom of your boat or your propellers, or how does that work?
Well, that's why they call it courtesy boat inspection. So you go up to, you know, the people, and you have a sign so that they can see that there's something going on. And we wear T-shirts, and, you know, we very courteously, with courtesy, come up to the people and say, have you ever had an inspection? And if you haven't, I'll explain why. And you know, all the time, I've never had anybody really give me a hard time.
Mm-hmm.
They will go, wow, you know, and you say, well, you don't want to get, you know, these invasive plants. And you hand them a brochure, and they DEP has made wonderful brochures. It has a map of the current locations of invasive plants. It has a drawing of how to inspect the boats and your equipment, your trailer. It also gives a description of the buoys that are out on lakes and what the, you know, symbols on the buoys mean. It's a fantastic resource.
And so are you looking for even the tiniest little bit of vegetation? Or what are the signs with respect to milfoil? It needn't be an obvious large chunk of milfoil hanging off a propeller or the part of the boat. It might be a very small piece.
Yeah, well, that's what you have to do. You have to look, because just a small piece, which the people that are with you will tell you, the small piece can actually start an infestation.
So then if you find it, then are you telling them you can't take your boat in, or what's the next step there?
Well, you can do that. You can tell them and explain why, you know, but you can also help them look around and make sure that there isn't anything else on there. You can also explain to people that, and you do it gently with courtesy, I'm telling you, so that's the most important thing of all, because you're not law enforcement. You're there to, you know, help protect a water body. And to tell people how to go about doing it, you just, you know, tell them that if you know there's anything else on the, they shouldn't go in the water, and explain to them about how even when a plant has been out of the water for a while, they can still infest. It's amazing. A little piece of these, like cadrilla and these invasive plants, your pea milfoil, just a little piece has been out of the water for a while. You put it in water and boom. Comes right back. It's amazing.
Yeah. Okay, Karen. Thanks so much for calling in today. This as she's talking, I'm getting a sense that, as she says, we are not law enforcement, John McFedrin, but they are kind of telling people, hey, you may not be able to bring your boat in. It seems it can be awkward, but is it working okay to the best that you know around the state?
Well, first of all, Karen, thanks for your efforts out there. I know the Hallies have been very involved from that area also. These are courtesy inspections, as she pointed out. They are not mandatory. Inspections are not mandatory in the state of Maine. They can't tell a boater you can't launch the boat. They can ask, may I inspect your boat, or may I help you inspect your boat? May I look, and they'll build your boat, see if there are plants in there, and that's it. If somebody, the real whole point of this, there are fines. If somebody travels on a public way with a plant on the outside of a boat, there could be a fine for that in Maine statute.
Assuming a warden,
you have to have a law enforcement officer find that, that's happened on a couple of occasions. The other thing is, if somebody launches a watercraft into a water body that has an invasive aquatic plant on it, that can be a penalty also. But prevention, she brings up, is our first line of defense. I mentioned before the monitoring that Voluntary Lake Monitoring Program organizes. We have a contract with Lakes Environmental Association in Bridgeton to coordinate the courtesy boat inspection program. Through that, we get grants out to local communities. We really try to get that money that we get from the sticker program, which we haven't touched on yet, Keith, but it's a dedicated funding source. And in 2014, we were able to put out about $340,000 in grants. That includes both inspection programs, for inspections programs, and also for efforts like Pam's talking about in Little Sebago to remove the plants.
So what's this in the sticker program?
For every motorized watercraft registration in the state, there is a $10 fee that's included in that registration fee. That $10 goes mostly to DEP and a smaller amount to Inland Fisheries and Wildlife. And that is the funding that supports our program. For boats coming from out of state that are registered out of state, they pay a $20 fee. That is also comes mostly to DEP, but some money to Fish and Wildlife. And that's what supports our program.
Okay. 1-800-399-3566. The number again, 1-800-399-3566. Email talk@mpbn.net, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page to Pownell and Matt. Hi, Matt.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call. I'm calling. I work for an organization called the Casco Bay Invasive Species Network, and we work primarily in terrestrial invasives now. I did want to make a point that has come up a little bit among your guests, which is that while it can seem like an overwhelming problem when people are realizing that they have, whether it's a milfoil infestation or in our line, a knotweed infestation, what we've found over and over again is that people who organize to combat and manage invasives is a community catalyst in a way that allows them to be real stewards and allows them to talk about stewardship with their community. So there's a real silver lining there that I think ought to be touched on. So
in the process of joining together in this unified fight, there are other projects or other things they can work on at the same time?
Exactly. That happens quite a bit, or just getting also education involved and getting people to talk about, okay, how does this matter for our kids? And you know, some of the coolest projects we've seen are ones that involve third and fourth graders going out and identifying plants, and they love it, and it's pretty rigorous scientific work. So it's there's a lot of benefit to actually getting down into doing the work, even though it can be overwhelming at first.
Yeah. Pam, yeah, go ahead. Did you want to?
It does, at some point, you want to prevent that burnout. And I think that, some of the things that really has worked for us is that the upper basin and the lower basin are 7 miles from each other. And we have, you're right, created a community of education. And it's almost infectious itself by being part of the process, and the education part is really important. And what we do is we try to reach out through public forums, and every time you speak with somebody, this forum is really great because you're reaching out to new people.
Are you finding an attitude out there that suggests, well, this is not my problem. I don't live near a lake. Those folks over near the lake, they enjoy it, so let's let them take care of it. Or do people invest in this problem even though they may not even take part in?
Well, it's not self-serving. You know, one of the reasons why we do this is not just because we own property on the lake. We do it because there are other people outside of the shoreline who do enjoy the lake, and we realize that's a benefit to them and a benefit to us. We can feel sometimes that we're not reaching out to them, but I think that most of the time, when we have a program where people will reach over to us to report that they have some sort of plant in their waters, and we'll go to them. It will identify whether or not it's native or if it's invasive, and that's the part that we like.
But John McFedrin, I'm just wondering I'm wondering if there is a little benefit to the state in terms of the interest that people who live around these properties and have a real interest in protecting them, to making sure that they're healthy. The state can kind of leverage that. And use that motivation to help it do its work, where in many other areas of environmental protection, there is no motivation.
Keith, you're stealing my thunder. You're exactly right. And I wanted, before talking about that, Pam, one of the things you made me think of is the effect on property values. So we're talking to people who are not on the lake benefit also financially, because lakefront property in many towns is a big component, a very large component of the tax base. And we have seen instances in Maine and in other states, but even in Maine, where property valuations were lowered because of invasive species infestations.
If I can break in just for a second, when we go to towns during the budget process and ask for some monies to support the program, that's just exactly what we say. You know, if the lake is compromised, then the property values will go down. Their property taxes will go up because the value has gone down, and so we try to reach out that it does affect everybody.
Yeah, we'll let you finish your thought in a second, John. But we're going to take a quick break. The number 1-800-399-3566. That's 800-399-3566. We'll go to Chris in Brunswick after we take a break. This is Maine Calling. Stay with us.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Maine's public universities. You can help make Maine even smarter and stronger. Learn more at think.maine.edu. Hospice of Southern Maine. Calling hospice doesn't mean you're giving up. It means you're taking charge. Learn more at hospiceofsouthernmaine.org. And the Law Offices of Joe Bornstein, a team of 75 professionals representing injured and disabled Mainers statewide, joebornstein.com.
Business can be all about the numbers. They tell you how well you're doing or whether you need to not do something. But not everybody cares all that much.
Clearly, whatever numbers exist that Netflix knows on a granular level are enough to make them happy. And if they're happy, that means that they have a business model that's working for them. That's all I need to know.
I'm Kai Ryssdal, Beau Willimon from House of Cards, next time on Marketplace from APM.
Join us for Marketplace this evening at 6:30. And join us this afternoon following main calling at 1 o'clock for the Commonwealth Club of California. Amy Stewart is the speaker, and she's the author of The Drunken Botanist, The Plants That Create the World's Great Drinks. The Commonwealth Club of California, coming up after main calling, here on MPBN Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Keith Shortall. You're listening to Main Calling. Today on the program, keeping Maine's lakes and ponds from being overrun by milfoil and other aquatic invasive species. With me in the studio, John McFedrin, biologist and coordinator of Maine DEP's Invasive Aquatic Species Program, Jacqueline Bailey, aquatic plant biologist and project director at Maine Milfoil Initiative, St. Joseph's College, and Pam Wilkinson, president of the Little Sebago Lake Association. We invite you to join the conversation. Give us a call, 800-399-3566. That's 800-399-3566. John McFedrin, before the break, we wanted to let you, you were making a point about the state kind of having some leverage in utilizing the self-interest of some lake and pond side owners to take care of this problem.
We're really fortunate to have the dedicated funding program I talked about, the sticker program. We're not dependent on general fund. We're also really fortunate to have so many dedicated volunteers and lake associations like Little Sebago out there. I think I mentioned that we had about $340,000 in grants this year that went out of our office. In 2013 alone, if you look at the match in terms of cash match but from these lake groups and volunteer match, it was over $920,000 of match alone. So the leverage is tremendous.
All right, and with that, we'll go to Brunswick and Chris. Hi, Chris.
Yes, hi.
Yeah, go ahead, please.
Yeah, I have a small pond in a kind of a woodland area. It's probably 150 feet long and maybe 75, 50 feet wide. I've got a real infestation of duckweed. I've identified it with photographs on Google Images, and I rake it off and, you know, try to pull it off to the side, and it just seems to come back looking for somewhat more of a controlled, what could I do with duckweed?
Okay. What is duckweed?
It's a very small floating aquatic plant. And it sometimes, well, Chris could probably tell us about what it looks like on his pond, but it can cover the surface of the pond.
Is it an invasive species or a nuisance?
Well, it is. Invasive species in Maine, the invasive aquatic plants are specifically listed in statute. There are 11 species. We've been talking about milfoil, but there's also hydrilla, several species of milfoil, water chestnut, curly leaf pondweed. Those are specifically listed in law. So because of that, if something is growing densely, like duckweed, there are limits on what can be done to do it, to control it. At this point, Chris, I think that what you're doing is probably the limit of what you can do at this point. Because it is a floating plant, it's not something that you're going to remove the roots from the sediment and then take care of the problem in that way. It's not something that you're going to put a barrier down to cover it. So I think raking it, sometimes people have tried literally using pool nets to net it out. It is a tough one.
Anything to add, Jackie?
No, I think that John has really covered that. Yeah.
All right, Chris. Well, good luck with that. I'd also read that there are some insects. There was a weevil I had read about that had been introduced that a researcher at Middlebury had discovered was a predator of certain types of – was it milfoil? I'm not sure, Jackie. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah. So there is a milfoil weevil that's out there that they use on Eurasian water milfoil. And what happens is they release large populations of the weevil into areas where there's a Eurasian water milfoil infestation. And so the weevil helps to diminish the population to some extent, but it doesn't do it all by itself. It does require additional efforts of management to get those milfoil populations under control. So it's a tool in the toolbox. It's not a silver bullet, I guess you could say.
It's always of concern, though, when you introduce another species to deal with one species, you can sort of create a chain of a trouble that you did not anticipate. Is that an issue?
Absolutely. That's always an issue. We don't want to have yet another new invader by introducing a biocontrol. But typically, these biological controls that are released are vetted pretty extensively before they're actually used in an area where they're not native.
Yep. Okay, let's go to Moosehead Lake area and Vivian. Hi, Vivian.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thank you.
I'm calling because a couple of summers, we have property up here, so we're up here in the summers, and a couple of summers ago, there was an issue with some milfoil. A neighbor called and said, do you know anything about it? We went out, we collected it, and we delivered it to the rangers at the state park here because there was a lot of signs up about dangerous milfoil and stuff. We took it to the rangers. The rangers said, okay, well, we have to have it, send it away to get identified, and we'll let you know. And a couple of weeks later, I get an answer that said, well, Maine has its own species, variety of milfoil. I think they said there were two of them, and this was one of the native species. So my question is that true? And secondly, if it isn't true, then what do we do? And if it's okay, I'll take my answer off the air.
Okay, Vivian. Thank you. Go ahead, Chris. I mean,
do you want to
Jackie? There's actually five native species of milfoil in Maine that have leaves. And so and I actually participated in a survey of Moosehead Lake a few years ago. It actually was about a five-year span that we did the survey. And I believe we found every single species of native milfoil on Moosehead. None of the invaders, just the native. So I wouldn't be surprised if that's indeed what they told her that she found, then that's probably what it was.
And I remember that we received some milfoils, it sounds like from that area, Moosehead, some years back, that were native.
And again, that you just can't tell by look because they're that similar?
All milfoils have what's called a feather-divided leaf. So it has a midrib, and then it has leaflet pairs on either side of that midrib. It really looks like a feather. And so it's, as John mentioned before, it's really difficult to tell milfoils apart unless they have that flowering stalk. And in many cases, they don't produce that flowering stalk. So we actually have to send it off to have a look.
And what are the controls that work naturally on the native milfoil that don't work on the invasive?
They tend to be growing in concert with or in association with other plants. I was out on Anabescuc Lake yesterday in Winthrop, Monmouth area. And when you look at the bottom of Anabescuc Lake, you see mat-forming plants, what we call mat-formers, low-growing plants. You see some plants that are then growing up into a little higher in the water toward the surface, and then you have some plants growing up at the top of the surface. So you have a diversity or a suite of native plants, and the milfoils tend to be mixed in with those. That's what we saw yesterday. They're mixed in. They're sharing space, sharing nutrients, sharing the substrate with these other native plants. They tend not to then grow like crazy and dominate and become a monoculture. Again, as I mentioned earlier, we do see some species growing quite densely that are native. So there's some circumstances where they might have a big patch of open ground, get a foothold, and grow densely, and yes, be native. But on the whole, they tend to grow in association, in concert with other native species in an area.
Okay. Let's go to Kennebunk and Harriet. Hi, Harriet.
Hi. How are you?
Good. How are you?
I'm fine. Thank you. I don't have a milfoil problem, but I have a knotweed problem. And I heard somebody mention that on the program a minute ago.
That was me.
Is that too far off the subject?
It's a little bit off the subject. We're talking about the Japanese knotweed. It looks like bamboo, yes. Kind of.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah, I have that too, but it is a little. I don't think any of our guests have much knowledge of that pest, unless they do. But it is off topic. But I'll throw it out there.
You have a specific question about control, or Harriet?
I would like to know what to do to control it or get rid of it.
Yeah, it's Jackie. You can chime in too. I know it's can be a real challenge. I know people have covered it with even linoleum weighted down with cement blocks to try to prevent it from growing. I know actually my aunt and uncle had a patch of it in their backyard, and they had it excavated.
Yeah.
They had all the material removed.
Yeah, he's digging down about 10 feet.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that that's almost one of the only ways to go. From the research that I've done looking, I had a neighbor that actually asked me that question too, and people have tried burning it. They've tried repeated cutting, but I think it's just one of those insidious little plants that just doesn't stop, and almost excavating it is the only way you can get rid of it.
And it will pop up if you leave something unattended. It'll take over immediately there. Harriet, I sympathize, but it looks like you might have to hire a digger. I guess that's the only answer there. Thank you for calling. Pam, I want to ask you, when your association makes, like many organizations have an annual plan or a strategic plan, what is your vision for controlling this problem? Is total eradication ever a dream or a goal, or are you just trying to stay ahead of it? How would you characterize
it? Not unless there's some magic out there. I think we've come to the point where we know we're going to be having this program from year to year. What our goal is not to have to work 5 days a week, 3 months out of the year. And we have reached that goal in the Upper Basin. So, you know, hopefully it won't cost as much to do the work. We want to try to get the Lower Basin as managed, but we will constantly be surveying. We'll be looking for fragments, new places that it has cropped up. And we know it's a continual battle, but we're gonna win that.
Let's go to Ben in Raymond. Hi, Ben.
Hi, I'm just calling. I know the three players, and they know me. I just wonder if they would speak a little bit to the rather really high cost of, as Karen was talking about, of getting to getting rid of the milfoil, because it can cost quite a bit of money to run a crew on a daily basis, and it can take a lot of days and a lot of years. So I will just leave it at that, because I realize you're close to the end of the day, and I just want to thank them for all the work that they do. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Okay, thanks, Ben.
I'll chime in on the cost on that. It is very costly. Our payroll is about $34,000 to $35,000. That's not on top of that is the supplies and the boat maintenance and that type of thing. But we are very fortunate to have lake residents who pay more than the $25 dues. We get about $25,000 to $30,000 in fees above that, and we also receive $6,000 from the state, and approximately $10,000 or $8,000 from the town of Gray and Wyndham. So we are constantly working. It's about a $50,000 project. Plus, you add the volunteer time on top of that.
So are divers, are there volunteer divers, or are you paying?
We worked with volunteers for a long time, and that's the recipe for burnout. You want to make sure that, you know, we still work on an awful lot of volunteer time. And then on top of that, we hire the divers and the crew and the captain. And we've decided also to hire a scheduler for the payroll and a supervisor that goes in the morning to just make sure that they have the gas and they have everybody's on the same page and knows where to go. And then after that, it's reports and interim reports and final reports and payroll and, you know, everything in a business.
Well, what would any of you say is sort of the for people listening who want to do something? What's the big need right now? We'll start with Pam. What is it? People? Is it volunteers? Is it?
I think it's education, training. The need is just identification. You know, if you can get early detection, then you don't have to go through this whole process. And so I don't want to scare anybody thinking that they can't fix it without $50,000. You can. We started slow in the beginning, and then realized that we have the resources around the lake who are interested in making sure that we keep this at bay. And so we are able to hire these people and offload some of the pressures and keep going with the project.
Yeah. John McFedrin, from the state's perspective, what's job one here or first on the wish list?
I would say, well, first on my wish list is that we all inspect our boat before and after using a water body. That sounds like an easy thing to do, but I've been boating for many years, and it took me a while to get that under my belt. Mm-hmm. The second thing I would say is to get involved. Pam told me before we went on that at the Lake Association meeting, they had 140 people attending. That's a huge turnout. And if you can have anything like that, that would be wonderful. So the other thing I would mention is that if anybody has any questions, they should certainly contact us. You know, Chris talking about the duckweed, and if he wants to talk about that more, we can always be reached at milfoil@maine.gov.
And we'll have all your contact information on our website and our Facebook page. Thanks, all of you, for being here.
Well, thank you.
Thank you.
John McFedrin, biologist and coordinator of Maine's DEP's Invasive Aquatic Species Program. Jacqueline Bailey, aquatic plant biologist and project director at Maine Milfoil Initiative at St. Joseph's College. And Pam Wilkinson, president of Little Sebago Lake Association. John Keimel ran the board today. Cindy Hahn answered your calls, and we had additional help from the MPBN web team. You can find past editions of Maine Calling, as well as a link to our podcasts, by visiting mpbn.net/Maine Calling. Tomorrow on Maine Calling, a Your Vote 2014 program checking in on the races for governor, U.S. Senate, and U.S. House here in Maine. And we're taking the show on the road. We'll be live from the Cumberland Club in Portland. I'm Keith Shortall. You've been listening to Maine Calling on the Maine Public Broadcasting Network.